Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly show about health, nutrition, fitness, and all things lifestyle. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney. Today we explore Bike to Work and School Week with Julia Collins from the Transportation Department at Park City Municipal. Julia is an avid cyclist and has lots of fun planned for this month, but especially on Friday, when the snow will magically disappear and the temperatures rise, and you can bike to work and school. She's going to tell us about those activities.
Then Emily Owens is a researcher at UCLA and a fourth-year doctoral student. She specializes in early detection of psychosis in adolescents. This early detection can help ward off full-blown schizophrenia later in life. She's coming to town next week on Wednesday to speak as part of the Connect Summit County May Mental Health Awareness Month.
And finally, considered to be the world's best rock climber, Tommy Caldwell, who in 2015 climbed the 3,000-foot Dawn Wall of El Capitan over 19 days along with his climbing partner. He's here to discuss his new book. It's called Push, A Climber's Journey of Endurance, Risk, and Going Beyond Limits.
Stay with us for this hour, but first we've got some significant traffic issues to talk about. A couple of accidents, on I-80 on the westbound near Lambs Canyon. One lane is closed. There's a truck jackknife there. And eastbound, the left lane is closed 1 mile east of the quarry, which is near the mouth of the canyon down low. So if you're going to or coming from Salt Lake, you've got some extra time that it's going to take. Be careful for that. And if you'd like to give us a call, an update, if you're out there on the road, we won't be answering the studio line during this hour, but you can call Ethel at 649-9004, extension 0. This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after this to talk about Bike to Work and Play Day coming up on Friday.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, celebrating 25 years in Park City. San Francisco Design is happy to sponsor public affairs programming on KPCW. For 25 years, we have been providing home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. We're located on Bonanza Drive and at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
Hi, this is Whitney Wall from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. This summer, Park City Mountain offers a variety of events for the whole family, including the annual July 4th celebration and fireworks, summer concert series, and weekly Wednesday Farmers Market. The full calendar of Park City Mountain events is available at parkcitymountain.com.
This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Lynn.
Well, it's
Did you get everything cleaned up there?
There was a hair protruding from the microphone. Okay. It's Bike to Work and School Month. And while it doesn't seem very suitable for biking this morning, although this is it's looking better out now, right now. Yeah,
I was a little grumpy this morning when I looked out.
I think there were a lot of grumpy people in town this morning. But May is actually a great month for riding your bike or walking the distance to work or to play or to school and taking notice of all the wonderful things around you. It's a mindfulness exercise. It saves money on gas. It's good for the air to take one more car off the road. Joining us from the Transportation Department at Park City Municipal is transportation guru and avid cyclist Julia Collins to talk about, well, mostly Friday, Ride to Bike, Work, and Play Day. Good morning, Julia.
Good morning, Lynn and Tim. Thank you so much for having me here.
Well, thanks for coming. You have really taken this whole month over with lots of activities, competition within your workplace, which is great. And then this Friday coming up is the big day, and it is going to be, I think, mostly clear. It'll be a little chilly, but everyone coming out, we all have gloves and hats under our helmets, right?
Exactly. You know, let's talk about the weather for just a second. The history of Bike Month is that it's always been in May. And here in Park City, things have been variable, and we never know what we're going to get in May and June. But we decided to continue with May as Bike Month, since it's a nationwide celebration. And one of my friends, her daughter is in third grade, and she said, no matter what the weather, if it's raining, if it's snowing, my daughter will get out there and ride to school for whatever that prize is that she's going to get, be it a donut or a Slurpee. She is just gung-ho. So we live here in Park City for the adventure, for these opportunities and the recreational opportunities. So even if it's rain or shine, you know, having fun on your bike is inevitable on bike to work or school day.
I like that. That is a great attitude. And we all, yeah, we all practice winter sports. So, you know, just wear your winter clothes if it's really cold and hop on the bike. So you have a variety of activities at the library, at the Olympic Plaza right next to Squatters, and you kind of partner with Mountain Trails Foundation to bring this on. Talk about some of the activities, you know, from when I hop on my bike at 7 a.m. or 7:30.
So there's a lot going on. Let me first start with the Bike to School Day. We're partnering with all of the elementary schools in Park City and in the Basin. For Park City specific, there's three locations, meeting at the PC Mark, the Aspenville Apartments, and then also the corner of Comstock and Sidewinder by the Arches Park. And meeting at 7:30, Park City Police Department will be escorting the kids safely to school on their bikes. And also the City Council has generously donated helmets. So if your kid needs a new helmet or doesn't have a helmet, the City Council will be generously handing out helmets at those three locations that morning. The other elementary schools Jeremy Ranch, Parley's Park, and Trailside Elementary will also be meeting at 7:30 and have organized rides with the Sheriff's Department to bring those kids safely to school. So that's exciting. During lunch, the Park City High School mountain bike team is leading a bike rodeo for the elementary students. And they have kind of a safety obstacle course to go through with prizes. And that's at McPolin. And then from 1 to 3, Basin Rec is partnering with the Sheriff's Department and the Summit County Health Department to provide a barbecue and bike safety rodeo. That's at Parley's Park from 1 to 3 for folks out in the Basin. So lots going on with Bike to School. It's really exciting to get those kiddos out. Promote safety awareness, education, and let them know how they can safely ride their bike to school. So now for the older generation, we also have some, or younger generations, but we also have a variety of bike to play and work events scheduled in Park City.
Well, and
so I can dive into those if you want, unless you have any questions about bike to school.
Well, I have a question, and it's stating the obvious, but, you know, we're in this mecca of recreational biking activity, and this is to actually change or shift the perception of the of what we use bicycles for, and it's starting to get people to think about them as a mode of transportation. And I think that's a big topic, and we almost take it for granted when we talk about the rodeos and the prizes at school and engaging the kids, but it's not to engage the kids like Young Riders does, to teach them, you know, bike skills and get them out there for recreational purposes. It's for all of us to recognize that bicycles across the world are used as viable modes of transportation.
Right.
We really haven't done that here in Park City.
Right.
I mean, and it's kind of amazing because everybody's got a garage full of bicycles.
Right.
So let's talk about that and what the actual intention is on a more overarching scale.
We could talk about this for an hour.
Yeah,
this
well,
is one of my favorite topics.
But you can't.
I know. So let's see.
But we have the bike, you know, the e-bikes coming in. That's a great, you know, example of how we're shifting this.
It's a great example. And how we think about the choices that we make on a daily basis to get around. You know, it is a paradigm shift. It is a different way of thinking of what are the different transportation choices that are available to me when I make that decision to either turn the key in the car or go for a walk or hop on a bike. And this is a regional transportation initiative that our team at Park City and Summit County and other partners are working on to provide the community residents with different choices on a daily basis. You know, I've often heard, hey, I live too far away to bike to work. Well, there's, you know, 20% of statewide trips are commuting trips, but we still have 80% of those trips, whether it's errands to friends, to all sorts of different tasks that we'd go about with our daily lives. I commonly use the example, I've sat outside at Kimball Junction just visiting the post office, and looked and said, well, I have to go to the library. I need to go to Petco to grab some cat food. I need to go to Smith's. I'd like to go to Best Buy, and I have to go to the bank. And all of those trips are within a half a mile of each other. Can I walk to those destinations, or at least half of those destinations? And these are choices that we're asking community and residents to really think about. Are there opportunities when you go about your daily lives that you could do those errands in a different way? Can you make that choice? And transportation, it's all up to all of us so that we're not all getting into the car. And if we can think about biking or walking, and ultimately that's what Bike Month is, raise awareness of all users on the road, whether you're in your car and you see a cyclist, whether you or your kid, you're riding to a destination, how do you go about that safely and what are the proper routes? How do you make sure that your bike is ready to get on the road, that you, you know, feel good when you hop on there, you've got a bell and you know what your hand signals are as you go about making your way to your destination. So we're all part of this solution together. And if we as the city and all of the partners that are working on these events can make it easier for you, this is just one step in that puzzle.
And we've got examples. Julia, you ride your bike to work, I know. Lynn, you've been making a commitment to ride your bike all this month. The mayor has been riding his bike to work. It's an e-bike. And we're getting an e-bike program in town landed right here in Park City that connects the Kimball Junction Transit Center to the Old Town Transit Center with, I believe, 9 stations and something like 800 bikes. Am I? No, it's not 800. No, it's 90 bikes or something like that.
You got the 8 right. 88 bikes in phase 1 and 180 docking stations between the basin and Park City. And that's only phase 1.
8 or 9 stations.
9 stations in the first rollout. Yeah. And then we're going to see in a phase 2 additional bikes and stations.
So we've got examples of people who are already using or, you know, trying to help us shift our collective consciousness about bikes as a mode of transportation. And now we're going to facilitate that with the infrastructure. And we're going to have an e-bike program right here where you can, I believe, use it for a period of time for free as long as you dock it again, run your errands, come back, and undock. You get to make the trip for free. Is that how it works?
I'm not sure of the pricing structure at this point. I know that the team that
free
is working
cheap.
On that, free or cheap.
Yeah.
I mean,
we'll have you back on when to talk about that when that kind of it is about set to go. I think it's in late June. But in the meantime, bike to school, work, and play on Friday, and all kinds of activities. Where can people go to find out about the day?
Please visit parkcity.org. And right on our homepage, you'll see our flyer with the additional events that'll be at the Park City Library and also the location adjacent to Squatters at the Olympic Welcome Plaza, in addition to the school locations for meeting up.
And but, then there are other events throughout the month, concluding with Mountain Madness at the Jim Santee.
Do we have time for me to highlight some of those things?
Or quickly.
Quickly. Mm-hmm. So Mountain Madness, we're partnering with the Mountain Trails Foundation at the Doubletree by Hilton, the Yarrow, right on Park Ave. That's March 31st, and there'll be some great films for you to learn about folks' experience, either bike commuting or adventure by biking. There'll be everything trails and all different trails advocacy groups, bunch of swag, and some great local champions of biking at that event, and that's 5:30 on the 31st. There's also a really cool, if you're thinking about having your own personal e-bike, an e-bike expo, and that's on the 19th to the 21st down in Salt Lake at the Smith's Ballpark, and it's all free. There's going to be over 80 different brands of e-bikes available. Over 16 can try, and if you bring your kiddos, there's cargo bikes that you can attach them to and go through this pretty extensive obstacle course to try those different brands for e-bikes. And lastly, there's Zoom Go Electric, which is part of the UCare, the UClean Air partnership. And through May 31st, all local dealerships of e-bikes are providing discounts. You can go to utahev.org, and our local pedago is also participating in that as
That's
well.
That's great. All kinds of activities, all kinds of information. Thanks for coming on. Julia Collins, Park City Municipal Transportation Guru and avid cyclist, and we'll see you out there on Friday.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
And we'll be back in a moment. We're going to talk about some really important mental wellness topics associated with Connect Summit County Mental Health Awareness Month. And we just want to remind everyone, Kevin Hines, who we spoke with last week on this show, is speaking this evening in the Jim Santee Auditorium at 6:30. And he, of course, incredibly compelling story about his jump off the Golden Gate Bridge with the goal of committing suicide. He survived. His life has changed. He speaks around the world on this topic of how to get help when you're struggling. He certainly knows that now. And again, this evening at the Jim Santee Auditorium, the talk is free. So please come on out. It will be, I guarantee, very interesting. Stay with us. We'll be right back after these words with Emily Owens.
Miller Orthodontics is a proud supporter of The Randy Barton Show. Since 1988, my wife and I have provided a combined 45 years of orthodontic care. For our Invisalign patients, we provide digital scanning and imaging technology that eliminates the need for wet molds of your teeth. More information is at m2ortho.com.
This is Damon Rogers, the new general manager of Park Meadows Country Club, proud sponsor of KPCW. I'm excited about the current clubhouse renovation, where we'll have expanded indoor-outdoor dining, mountain views, a new fitness center, and locker rooms coming this fall. More info at parkmeadowscc.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Are you worried about your child's behavior beyond, you know, just the natural worry, even after assurances, perhaps, by your physician? Do things just not seem okay with that behavior, with the responses? We welcome Emily Owens. She's from the Center for the Assessment and Prevention of Prodromal States. Its acronym is CAPS. It's at UCLA. It's a clinical research center. And she specializes in identifying and treating adolescents and young adults between the ages of 12 and 30 at high risk for developing psychotic disorders. And Emily Owens will be in town next week on May 24th, a week from today, to speak about her mission and this early detection. She'll speak at 6:30 p.m. at the Park City Hospital in the new conference area, the Blair Center. Emily Owens, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. You're doing some really fascinating work. I have to ask you, first off, this is all about early detection for adolescents at high risk for developing psychotic disorders. You say it's in the prodromal phase of schizophrenia.
Right.
Can you define that?
Yes, I can. The prodromal, the word prodrome really just means an early warning sign of any illness. So for psychosis and schizophrenia especially, I think it's helpful first to define what psychosis is. So it's really typically the cardinal features are hallucinations, so seeing and hearing things that aren't really there, and delusion, so kind of any kind of thought content that's not based in reality. And so the majority of people with schizophrenia, the onset of their more fully psychotic symptoms are preceded by a period of time where they exhibit these kind of milder symptoms that look like kind of low-grade psychotic symptoms, so more subtle changes in beliefs, thoughts, and perceptions. And so that period we refer to as the prodrome, because it's kind of a warning sign. It's often also accompanied by a decline in functioning. Mm-hmm. So people stop spending time with their friends, their family. They maybe start doing worse at work or school. And so it's really a good time to start intervening.
You know, so many parents of adolescent kids are, you know, I feel like they're all looking for changes in behavior. And, you know, when we talk about depression, for example, a lot of those early symptoms are things that all adolescents kind of go through. Like sometimes they spend too much time in their room, or they change friends, or they, you know, and so you hear all of these symptoms as a parent and you go, well, you know, my child has this or that. But really, this is, it's first of all, looking at all these symptoms together. And then what you're talking about, there's some real different twists on it, like confusion right. about what is real and what is imaginary, you know, in addition to all of these other symptoms that would be sort of a signal of maybe depression. But talk about some of those twists.
Definitely. No, and you make a really good point. It is very hard for parents to kind of identify what these signs are. And so our advice is always, if you're concerned, take them to the doctor, take them to a psychologist, and kind of get it checked out. But the more kind of distinct features of a psychosis or prodrome maybe an example would help. So some kind of worried thoughts about maybe a high school student who sees a Facebook post that if anybody else saw it, they would think it's just a generic post. It's definitely not meant for me. But a person in the prodrome might have some concerns that maybe that post is directed specifically at me. And then they might spend some time worrying about that, maybe doing some research on it to see if it is directed at them. But they're not going to become fully convinced of that idea. They can kind of generate some self-doubt and say, maybe it's just a coincidence that I happen to be thinking the same thing when I saw this. But what you really see is kind of the more, I guess, concerning signs that maybe parents can see is spending a lot of time invested in thoughts that aren't, that don't make sense to you. That I think is kind of a good sign for parents to maybe start seeing somebody.
Emily, you're part of the Connect Summit County speaker series, and we've talked to some other people who are part of that series as well. And one of them is Gail Hornstein. We talked to her a couple weeks ago. She was fabulous, and she's already spoken mm-hmm. here in Park City as part of the series. But one of the things that she talked about was, determining what's real and what's not real. And when I hear you talk about mm-hmm. psychosis, you know, one of the things that jumps out at me is you're saying, you know, hallucinations and deciphering reality from imagination. But as somebody who's experiencing that, that's pretty darn real. And then how do we determine, you know, what is real and what is not real? And Gail pointed out it's really the relationship we have with, she was using voices that people hear, but you could use, mm-hmm. you know, and those were what, audio hallucinations. You can use visual hallucinations, but anything that could be kind of, you know, is it real? Is it not real? And here we are talking about, it's clearly, you know, you seem to have a line that delineates between what is real, what is not, and that's a psychosis.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say there's a clear line. There's always definitely some blurriness of it. It takes a lot of very thorough assessment to kind of suss out what is happening. And that's, I think, what we've really learned at CAPS. We do pretty extensive assessments. We're asking a lot of questions, and we ask a lot of follow-up questions. So maybe somebody has thoughts that people are trying to harm him or her. An important question to follow up is, are you being bullied at school? Is that maybe a real concern that you have, and maybe can we intervene at that level? So definitely, I don't think there's ever a clear yes or no. Maybe when you get into the really full psychosis, you can definitely tell. But in the prodromal stage, I mean, that's really how it's defined, is that it's this kind of confusing state. And it takes a lot of assessment, a lot of follow-up, and it's just something you kind of want to keep your eye on.
And then what can parents and kids do if it is determined mm-hmm. that they are in some state or early state or full-blown state of psychosis? What's the next step after, you know, what you do at your center?
Definitely. So, I mean, that's really where research is kind of working on that problem right now. In an earlier prodromal state, there's no clear answer. We definitely want to monitor those symptoms. Therapy is always a good idea, both to kind of decrease stress and to help monitor those symptoms. We want to keep people engaged in their lives, out of their rooms, off the computer, and still going to school. So there's no real evidence, solid evidence, for preventative measures at this time. I think the most promising thing we've seen from the literature is cognitive behavioral therapy. Then when you get into an actual psychotic episode, that's when you definitely need to be talking about medication, usually antipsychotic medication with a doctor. And of course, therapy is always going to be helpful, either just for the individual or maybe as a family. You can really not go wrong with doing therapy. So those are definitely the first steps to start taking.
I want to go back to, because I'm reading a list of some of these signs and symptoms that mm-hmm. may be early onset. And I have to say that if people are listening to this interview right now, they may be saying, well, you know, a lot of us, when we see a Facebook post, might think that's about me. You know, there's a difference mm-hmm. between being sort of feeling like a victim or feeling like you're bullied. A lot
right.
of kids who don't have early onset psychosis are, you know, still are in that kind of victim role. There are a couple of others that I think are worth mentioning, symptoms. And this has to do with sensitivity to sounds and mm-hmm. easily kind of, you know, just a heightened or a hypersensitivity to background noises. This one's interesting, smelling, tasting, or feeling unusual sensations that other people don't experience. So these mm-hmm. perceptual disturbances are some another aspect that I find interesting that parents might want to know about.
Definitely. And I'll also say, really what we're looking for is a constellation of symptoms. So not just one or two things that maybe, yeah, bothered you that day and the next day you forgot about it. We're looking for things that are bothering people for months. Maybe they're getting worse over time. They're getting in the way of doing homework, of talking to friends that you used to talk to. You're dropping out of clubs and sports that you used to love. So it's kind of, when you put it all together, it is more apparent than just these symptoms alone. And yes, definitely the perceptual ones are also something that we ask a lot about. So hearing something that might not really be there, seeing kind of shadows. And again, these are all things that happen to a lot of people and they think nothing of it. It's when you start really investing time in thinking about what is that? Maybe that was something that was meant for me. Maybe that means something really bad is going to happen to me. And then that gets in the way of doing the things that you're supposed to be doing.
Do you find with the people that you work with, well, I guess if they're coming to you, or, you know, if someone's coming to someone like you for help, that means they're not in denial at all. But with this particular, you know, psychosis, early onset, when kids are adolescents, do you find that there's a lot of denial going on? And the reason I say this is because I have a dear friend, a lifetime friend, whose sister became schizophrenic, and the family really was in denial for a very, very, very long time, well past the point that they could have helped.
Right. Well, yeah, there's kind of two things there. One is that, as you said before, these experiences are very real to the individual who's experiencing them. And so sometimes people can delineate between, I know this voice is in my head and it's not real, but a lot of times they can't. And so that is really where treatments like medication, therapy, that is really going to be necessary in that case. The other part of that is, yeah, with the family, I mean, it's scary. It's a really scary disorder. It's not that well understood, especially by the general public, and there's still a lot of stigma around it. I think you guys see it a lot in movies and things like that, that it's something bad happened to you or it's your fault that this happened, and that's not the case at all. And so a lot of what we're trying to do still is break down that stigma so that people will go to the doctor when they need help.
I'm somewhat struggling with the idea of, what is a problem and what's real and what's imaginary? And, you know, you've said, Emily, and I like this, you say, if people start to do things that keep them from doing what they should be doing, and that's a tough one, too, because that's kind of subjective. I mean, we're putting all these, you know, definitions of what people should be doing. And what we learned from Gail was through relationship with what's happening, you know, that can take you on different paths and have different outcomes. Like you can hear voices and become a very high functioning, wonderful clairvoyant, or you can become a psychotic mess. Right. So,
right.
And I guess what we're trying to do is, you know, accept and create room and space for those who are high functioning and embrace clairvoyancy and help those who have that challenging, difficult relationship with whatever's happening and disengages them from what we think is, you know, some definition of a healthy and high functioning and engaged life. So to me, it's that engagement component. Is that fair to say?
Definitely. I definitely agree. I mean, we do see it's more rare, but we do see people who hear voices and have these experiences, and they are functioning completely fine. And they sometimes say the voices are helpful to me and they get me through rough times. And so in that case, then yeah, we kind of say, great, we're glad that you're functioning well. And if things start to kind of go downhill or if you start to become concerned, then come back and we'll talk about it and we'll see what to do. Absolutely. It's definitely, we're always looking at, is the patient in distress? Are they not functioning the way that they would like to be functioning?
Our guest is Emily Owens. She's with the UCLA Center for the Assessment and Prevention of Prodromal States, known as CAPS. She'll be in Park City next week, a week from today, May 24th at 6 p.m. at the Blair Conference Center at Park City Hospital. I think I may have said 6:30 before, but it's at 6 p.m. Kevin Hines, however, is speaking at 6:30 p.m. tonight at the Jim Santee Auditorium. Both of these events are free, and if you can believe it, between tonight and next week, there are a bunch of other events that Connect Summit County is putting on. Just go to their website to check out the calendar of events. All very important, very useful. It's connectsummitcounty.org. And Emily Owens, thank you so much for joining us today. We'll look forward to your talk next week.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment for a really I'm so looking forward to this conversation with the world's most renowned climber, Tommy Caldwell. He's the one who in 2015 climbed the El Capitan, 3,000 feet, the Dawn Wall, when we return.
Whether it's an act of lust or an act of violence, Don Giovanni does whatever he wants to whomever he pleases. You might be surprised by how much angst and unrest resonate with you in this hypnotic tale of a man who refuses to change. Damn the consequences. Join Utah Opera's rousing performance of Don Giovanni May 13th to 21st at Capitol Theater. For tickets, visit utahopera.org. The Utah Symphony Utah Opera is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Park City Storage proudly stores the stuff of KPCW, offering climate-controlled storage units with covered loading areas, packing and moving supplies, and use of a rental truck. Storage sizes accommodate storing a car, boat, furniture, or just stuff, located in the Silver Creek Business Park, 645-7900 or parkcitystorage.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Our next guest is considered to be the world's best rock climber. He's been named one of National Geographic's Adventures of the Year. He's been awarded the American Alpine Club's highest honor. In 2015, Tommy Caldwell, along with his partner Kevin Jorgensen, climbed the 3,000-foot Dawn Wall of El Capitan over 19 days. He's written a new book about it and really about his amazing life. It's called The Push, A Climber's Journey of Endurance, Risk, and Going Beyond Limits. Tommy Caldwell, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
Wow, I can't believe I'm speaking with you right now. I remember a couple of years ago. I mean, it was such really a media frenzy following you and your partner, Kevin, up that wall for days and days and days on end, and people just did not get sick of it. I mean, how do you think the media frenzy happened?
I take great pleasure in the fact that I made a heck of a lot of people neglect their normal lives and their daily jobs for like a week. That was pretty fun. But, you know, I think the media caught hold of it for a lot of reasons. There was a lot of negative stories out there, and this was a really positive story. It was a very uplifting story. It also was sort of the first time that people were able to capture this glimpse of big wall climbing, like this very, very exciting activity, which really we could deliver to people through social media. The use of social media from extreme environments like the side of El Cap is a very new thing. So, and then I think the other part of it is we weren't selling anything, though. On the other hand, we're projecting the story, but we were just telling what we were doing on a day-to-day basis. So it just felt like this really real, genuine experience, and people could very easily get behind it. And it was, they got to watch kind of these dreams come true. Like, we didn't know if we were going to succeed. We actually, all odds were against us, and then it worked out in the end. So that's a story anybody can love.
Oh, yeah. Well, so it's called the biggest, blankest wall of 3,000 vertical feet. It's the Dawn Wall. And when you say blankest, that means that there are very few little handholds and footholds. And you're talking about, like, you know, the width of a dime or something like that. Isn't that right? The whole way up?
Yeah, we spend our lives training ourselves to be able to grab onto these, you know, these really, really small edges on the rock. Sometimes too small to really even be able to see with your eye very well. You have to feel for them, and then climbing something like the Dawn Wall is a matter of finding a series of those in this really improbable spot up this very blank looking section of wall that from even 15 feet away it looks totally blank, but when you get right up close to it, you start to notice that there's a little bit there, and if you're trained properly, you can figure out a way to climb it.
Hey, Tommy, help the listeners and Lynn and I understand some of the definitions, the free climbing, kind of walk us through a little bit of the logistics and free climbing, free ascent, you know, the difference and solo free climbing, some of these things that come into play that I'm sure people don't have a clear understanding of. And that'll help us understand what you've done.
Right. So free climbing is a very confusing term. People think the word free means that you don't have any ropes. Like, if you fall, you're going to die. That's not actually the case. What we're doing is we're climbing the surface of the rock, you know, finding those little edges. But we did have the ropes there to catch us in case we fell. And actually, we fell quite often. And so we broke the route into 32 sections or 200-foot pieces. And then we would climb each 200-foot section and then haul up our camp and our supplies to that. And then we'd try the next. And if we fell, we only had to return to the bottom of that 200-foot section. It's very much a game of rules. But once we left the ground, we couldn't return back to the ground, you know, until we failed or finished. It formats this very dramatic experience of having to just live on the side of the cliff until you just can't go any farther.
And is the wall, is the angle completely vertical? Is it a straight line, or is there a little slant that is helping you? Or sometimes I would think it's even working against you. You're climbing kind of in an inverted fashion.
Yeah, it varies as you go up. It's a very big wall. So the bottom part is a little less than vertical. And as you get higher, it tends to get steeper. So the top is a little bit more than vertical. Overall, it's about vertical, though. Yeah, it's like climbing straight up a...
That last part you just said, that at the top, it's a little more than vertical.
Right, yeah.
Did climbing up to that last section prepare you and help for your final push through the a little more than vertical part?
Yeah, I mean, we prepared for 7 years. We had to practice and find this route for 7 years, and so we were preparing all along. Topping out was quite exciting.
Well, and that's the thing that I think a lot of people don't understand is this whole thing was studied, like you say, for 7 years. You even, at this particular point in your life where I think you said you were banging your head against the Dawn Wall, you went to the top and you kind of had this self-belay system, or you rappelled down to study certain parts of it. You set up, which is funny, it's not a base camp, it's a portaledge where you're kind of 1,500 feet halfway up the wall, and you set up this little camp to study the wall. I mean, that is just so fascinating to me.
Yeah, you know, we took the sort of style that people use in big Himalayan expeditions, where you set up these camps along the way, and we applied that to El Capitan. And so, yeah, we had these portaledges, these hanging cots, these tents that we would essentially live in, and we'd position them in strategic places along the route so that we could have access to working out the sections in between those camps.
There are so many questions that I have just about the climb in and of itself, but the book is about so much more. It's about the relationship with your father who took you out. I mean, you were on walls. There are pictures in your book. You're like 3 years old when you're rock climbing, and some really early ascents of the 14ers in Colorado. And then that relationship with a father who pushes, but then a son who, you know, I think some kids who are pushed by their parents fall away and rebel. You embraced, and it kind of helped this focus that you know, that was kind of second nature to you, or that you developed along the way naturally. Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, I was a pretty shy, awkward kid. I had bad eye coordination issues, which meant that I couldn't read. And so I was one of these people that just, like, didn't fit in socially that well. And climbing was probably the first thing that I fully connected with. And since I didn't fit in anywhere else, climbing became everything to me. And my dad recognized that, and he fostered that. And he was an adventurous person himself. And, yeah, that was just kind of he was amazingly insightful, because he was a school teacher, and he encouraged me not to go to college because he saw how, how much climbing meant to me. He definitely never encouraged me to take the safe route, which really was, you know, I owe everything to that.
Yeah.
So Tommy, this is kind of a two-part question, but it relates very closely one part to the other. You know, you just mentioned that you had this complete, total commitment and dedication to climbing for a long period of your life, and I assume, I'll just make the assumption, you're still in that phase. So the question is, now that you and Kevin have done this particular climb, have you broken trail for others who will follow, or do you think it's highly unlikely that there will be other Tommy Caldwells that have this sort of dedication, commitment, and all the components that came into play to give you the skill set, the determination, and the intent to do this?
Oh, there will absolutely be people doing things like the Dawn Wall in the future. I think to climbers, one thing that was really cool, like one of the barriers that we broke through, is historically people pick climbs they're relatively certain they will do, and then they go and attempt them, and they either succeed or they fail. Kevin and I, we picked a climb that we knew we were going to fail at over and over and over again, and we allowed that to happen until we became better, stronger. You know, we just challenged ourselves with something that was so far above us that it took 7 years to do. And I think people found that incredibly inspiring. And I think already in the last 2 years, you see that mentality taking hold. It's, you know, sort of transforming all the different sects of climbing, not only big wall free climbing, but bouldering and sport climbing and, you know, Himalayan climbs and all these different things. People are just taking this much broader view of it.
You know, that's fascinating, because that's how things evolve, right? I mean, we push the envelope, somebody jumps outside, instead of a step, they take a leap, and others follow. How far can this go? I mean, what are people capable of doing? You just said it took you 7 years of trial and error, and you had to build strength and get better. And how much better can you get? Let's just look at you and Kevin. How much better could the two of you get, and what is possible?
Yeah, I mean, this kind of climbing is a very physically rigorous activity, and you know, I'm 38, and so for this athletic style of climbing, that's getting kind of old, honestly. So I don't know how far I can push it. So what we do is we tend to go into more and more adventurous forms of climbing, where we rely on our experience more than our just brute strength that tends to come easier when we're younger. The problem is those more adventurous forms of climbing tend to be more dangerous, so it's this constant balancing act. So I could go into those more dangerous forms of climbing, but I'm a father, and I don't want to die. So I think my path forward is, you know, probably more to become a teacher, to kind of pass the torch.
What you just mentioned, something that I think is fascinating. You said these other forms of climbing are more dangerous, and yet Lynn and I see what you've done and accomplished in the photos and the cover shot, and I can't think. I'm sweating here. My hands are sweating thinking about what you've done. So yeah, that seems like the ultimate in danger to me, but that's because I don't understand it. So why are other forms of climbing more dangerous than what you did? Because my perception is it couldn't be any more dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite things about adventure climbing is this like repeated process of looking at something that seems unlikely or, you know, impossible maybe, and breaking it down to its elements and making it possible. And part of that is taking things that seem really dangerous and figuring out how to make them safe. On the side of El Cap, we're climbing this sheer face, but we have strong ropes. We have these protection systems that we've developed or that have been developed for us. And, you know, we take long falls. Like sometimes we'll fall up to 60 feet down the side of the wall, but the ropes are strong, so they catch us. So what that ends up doing is you have this very exciting, engaging activity that seems emotionally like it should be dangerous, but it's not all that dangerous. And, you know, I find that very fulfilling. It's, you know, it's kind of the perfect balance for me.
So again, a definition, free solo climbing, that's when you're climbing with no ropes. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. That okay. means if you fall, you die. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you do that ever? Or is
no,
that just
I mean,
against
you? Not really. Sometimes on a very, very, very easy level. That
yeah.
I'm
just bouldering.
Totally certain I won't fall on. Sometimes in big mountain environments, you just end up having to do that for efficiency's sake. But I stay away from it. Basically.
Right. So again, the Dawn Wall, like I said, there's so much to talk to you about your book, but the Dawn Wall for our listeners has been climbed before. In fact, like Royal Robbins, I believe, Yvon Chouinard, you can tell me who the first ascent was, but they did it with ropes and devices that can help you ascend up the rope.
Yeah, so the way the wall was first pioneered is that you would pound metal pitons, or these, you know, bits of metal into the cracks, or you would drill little holes and place bolts, and then you would attach these ladders to the pitons or the bolts, and then you would actually climb the protection. So that's called aid climbing, and that's how the roots get climbed first. But then we come along and we still use that protection to catch us, but we try and climb the features of the rock.
Two other big challenges, or two of the other challenges in your life. One happened to be when you cut off your index finger with a table saw. Absolutely amazing. The other one was when you were captured by Islamic militants in Kyrgyzstan when I think you were about 21. Was that right?
Yep. Yeah. The book has some darkness in it. You know, I had to go through some pretty hard times to get to the place where I was and figure out how to use those to fuel me. And I think that's really the power in this book. It's the story of overcoming adversity in a lot of ways. And both those experiences were part of that journey.
Wow. So it's the index finger of your left hand. And I've been sitting here on the radio because no one can see me, testing out the relative strength between my fingertip of my index finger and just the first digit most proximal to your hand. And I've decided that in the end, your fingertip is stronger. But what do you say?
Yeah, not having a left index finger is pretty... Like, it's a bad thing for a climber.
Yeah.
You know? But when I cut it off, it mentally toughened me because I was afraid that I was going to lose this life as a full-time climber, which I absolutely loved. So I became very dedicated on to overcome that. And it also pushed me on, more in the direction of adventure climbing, where, you know, on some level I knew that in the more gymnastic styles of climbing, I would never be able to reach my full potential. So I went to something slightly less gymnastic, which is, you know, more adventurous forms. So yeah, it's all a balancing act.
Tell me, who's the book meant for? What's your target audience?
You know, I think I wrote it to climbers specifically, because that's my audience. Like, I want my friends and my family to appreciate it the most. But I wanted it to transcend that. I think that it's a story of these sort of extreme circumstances, but, you know, the characters, and especially myself, are actually very normal people. So I hope that it will, I don't know, inspire people to step outside of their comfort zones and sort of embrace the journey. And I think anybody can do that. I mean, I think it was funny, after the Dawn Wall, like, for a couple weeks, I would have, seriously, old ladies coming up to me on the streets in tears telling me how inspired they were by that thing. I'm like, old ladies are just not the demographic I thought would be inspired by big wall climbing. And that was really cool.
Well, so much of it is about overcoming obstacles, having this sharp focus for something that you want so much, and even about finding that thing that you want so much. And I just have one final question for you, and that's about, especially after your release from the Islamic militants in Kyrgyzstan. What happened there that changed you?
Yeah, so I'll just give a brief rundown. In my first international climbing expedition, when I was 21, a group got captured by a group of Islamic militants from the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan. Yep, and this was like an Al Qaeda affiliated group, and it was this incredibly life-changing experience. Like, we were held hostage for 6 days without food or water. We all lost like 20 pounds. We're on the verge of hyperthermia in the high mountains, and we, you know, eventually escaped when I pushed our captor off a cliff and we ran for it. And so, you know, this experience like messed me up in a lot of ways emotionally for a while, but it was also kind of empowering because it showed me what we are capable of. Like, we withstood so much like physical and sort of mental anguish that it reset my bar for things like that. And in comparison, everything since has felt manageable. Like, I don't walk through life with much fear because I know it can't really get much worse than that.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. That was a great description. Well, our guest is Tommy Caldwell. Not only is he the world's best climber, he's the father of these two adorable children and a husband, and now writer of the book, The Push, A Climber's Journey of Endurance, Risk, and Going Beyond Limits. I think you ought to come to Park City and give a talk.
Yeah,
you're pretty close.
Definitely should. I've actually had a lot of Utah residents reach out to me and be like, "Why aren't you coming here on your tour?" I feel very obligated at this point because Utah is you know, one of the two best states in the country for outdoor climbing and just like our public lands in general.
All right. Well, anytime. You're welcome.
Yeah,
We'd love to have you. Thanks so much for joining us, Tommy. Thanks.
Thank you.
And we want to thank our underwriters.
They are Park Meadows Country Club, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Phil Davidson Orthopedics, Park City Mountain, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, and Zions Bank.
And we'll be right back after this.
It did. It was very, very cathartic.
Sundays on Weekend Edition, we bring you the voices connected to the news in a uniquely personal way.
You know, the care that I needed at that time in my life was really, really beneficial.
That is real stress. One-on-one.
He was just so easy to talk to.
I'm Rachel Martin. Join me for the Sunday Conversation on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Sunday morning starting at 6, sponsored by Utah Rugs.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life. Incredible. That guy's got so much energy. Wow. Really interesting book as well. You've been listening to KPCW Park City. It's time now for national news from Washington.